Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming BBC production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 5 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
Summer and I would like to once again welcome back our A Discovery of Witches friend, Jen Tepp. How are you doing, Jen? Are you feeling better?
I am feeling better. Thank you. I will say that kind of doing a little bit of reading definitely helped me, kind of get it together.
Well, that's a good thing because we are going to be discussing what we've read. So hopefully our minds are on at this slightly, not too late at night, but, you know, after a long day.
No, and hopefully we pick up somewhere right around where we left off, because I think we were at a really good place after chapter one. We were on so many different tangents. We had so much going on. So I'm hoping we can continue with that thread from here on out.
So chapter two begins. We find out it is 7 a.m. And again, Diana is in the library. Such a... You can tell she's a scholar. She's definitely an academic. And Ellen G. writes, Deborah paints such a beautiful picture of twilight in the library with the pools of golden light, resisting temptation using magic, a book out of reach, using her mind to bring it down into her hands, and then it opened to the page she wanted. So that's getting a tiny bit ahead of ourselves.
Did you just say 7 a.m. and then say twilight in the same sentence?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I was very confused.
Yeah.
Well, she describes her day in this, and then she talks about the weekend. So there's a lot of back and forth in this one chapter.
Okay.
But it starts, I believe, we find out at 7 a.m. And it's the 21st, the evening of the autumn equinox.
Autumnal equinox.
Autumnal. With the excuse of having to prepare for a conference, she's staying away from local witches and their celebrations. Of course, we already know that she distances herself from all magic, or at least she says she does for appearance's sake. And she doesn't need this excuse of a conference. Even if there were no conference, she wouldn't be hanging out with no witches.
No. I think definitely in chapter two, and as it bleeds into chapter three, even more of this level of cognitive dissonance she has going on regarding her magic use. You know, when she discusses previously why she uses magic, or even how she can use magic, right? We know that there are certain things that she just can't do. She can't do potions. She can't do certain spells. She can't hide pimples or color hair. But she can fix the washing machine. So I think that what's kind of great here is that we've had a sort of this skip, this hit and miss about how Diana can and can't use her powers and under what conditions and what she thinks of her own use of her powers. I think that definitely in chapter two, picking up on a previous thread that we discussed on chapter one, the lady doth protest a little too much.
Clearly. That's an ongoing thing.
So she'd spent the weekend on, she says, routine tasks. And this day, and are we to assume it was a Monday? Because she talks about the weekend. So it's, I presume, a Monday. She spends the day reading. I noticed that Deb mentions, quote, two coiled weights. And even though it's been quite a few years, when I studied paleography at St. Andrews in Scotland, we also had these when we were in the rare books portion of the library. Then we were introduced to them as snakes. And yeah, because they coil up. They're long, skinny weights, basically, that can coil like a snake.
Can they hold the pages open?
Well, that's the thing is, it's so, yes, you put them on the page and you can bundle them up, you can lay them out so they can hold a page down so you're not, number one, so you have easier access, right? So you're not having to hold it down with your arm and then look over here with your finger and find what you're trying to read. But mostly, besides making it easier to read or easier to access, it's so you don't put more fingers or weight or less human touch, if you will.
Are we going to post a picture of what you're describing?
A snake? Ah, sure.
I would like to see it.
I can look for one.
Okay, thank you.
She was working on her list of to-dos. She needed to look up notes and queries, and it happened to be located high on a bookshelf. Of course it did. If she reached it, the scene would not have happened. If she could reach it with her hand, she would have. So she uses the stairs to get as high as she can. But it was, of course, on the highest shelf, and she couldn't reach it. And she was hearing things again, we learn.
Super convenient. And isn't that the book that you want is like the farthest away on the highest shelf that you literally can do almost everything but reach it?
I think what's interesting is that Deb takes that moment for Diana to remind us that this was the fifth time this year that she had been spurred to use magic. So, and I think what's really kind of clever is she mentions that specific number. Like, it's not like, oh, it's like one of the few times or the couple of times or whatever. We have an exact number, and it's the fifth time. So I don't know if that like kind of, you know, pushes it over the edge or not. But I think what's really interesting is before we even get to that part, we have Jillian back again. And yes. Isn't she an absolute delight and a treat?
Diana would disagree.
I don't know why Diana doesn't spend more time with her. She seems like such a treasure. That Jillian. The more that Jillian is brought up, the more I'm like, wow, I really kind of didn't realize how much I loathe this character.
And I have so many friends named Jillian that I love so dearly, and yet this name has taken on such a negative connotation thanks to this book.
I know, like at page 16, kind of the third paragraph there towards the end. Given the Wiccan holiday, even Jillian had left late in the afternoon after extending one final invitation and glancing at my pile of reading material with narrowed eyes. I would have immediately been like, you know what, hold up, Jillian, let's be besties.
Yeah, exactly.
let's make this craziness happen. I mean, she's just like, you know, and I was also thinking, you know, since Diana is our narrator, obviously, right, at this point in the story, what if her views of Jillian are a little aggressive and a little harsh? We also don't know that as well. We don't get any purports of Jillian other than Em and Sarah talking about her a little bit later in the chapter. But we don't know anything about her, really. We just know that Diana doesn't like her. And so whether or not Jillian is guilty of any malfeasance at this point, I think it's kind of left to the reader to decide whether or not Diana is really assessing the situation objectively. I mean, Jillian has her own invested interests, just like everyone else does, correct?
Correct.
We just don't like it because her interest seems to lean towards the potential, if not in fact, victimization of Diana. But it occurred to me that as I'm reading this, the more invested I got into extremely disliking Jillian in this read-through, I just started thinking to myself, my God, everything I know about her is what Diana tells me. And so what if Jillian's just kind of like, I don't get this witch, whatever, I'm just going to keep inviting her because I know her aunts.
Yeah, and also, I just thought of something. It's possible that she's doing someone's or the coven's bidding. She could be the person that they like, look, this falls to you because you're an academic and you're there and you have easy access, so you make this happen.
Or maybe, I mean, not to go too far off a ledge, maybe Jillian's caught between two things. I mean, she does have some association with Diana's family. We find that out at the end of the chapter, right? Have you been hanging out with that witch from Bron Mawr? And, you know, then we find out how Emily and Sarah know her. And it's because, I mean, Sarah had that affair with her mother.
Yeah.
So she's somebody that's kind of already contextualized, right? And so to my mind, I don't wonder if Diana had loathed her a little less or had loathed what Jillian represented a little bit less. Would we think differently of her?
Do you think that Emily had any part in that?
I think that any time that Emily puts the screws to Diana, she shoots in the opposite direction.
That's fair. She pretty much is like, I don't want, just like Diana says and mostly does, avoid magic or using magic. I think she kind of, and it's related to her, the same reasons are at the root, I believe, of her not using magic, or part of her reasons for not using magic. And that is, she just doesn't want, she wants to avoid conflict. She wants a normal life without anyone bugging her, without her bugging anyone. She wants to stick to her stuff, do her stuff. She's good at what she does. And not have the trouble of magic and, as she says, all the strings that are attached with it. Because that's conflict.
It is. And I mean, not to jump too far ahead, on page 25, which is still in chapter 2, we have the quote, I'm not using magic or witchcraft to figure out why a vampire asked me to dinner. I said firmly, not negotiable, Sarah. So it's a negotiable reason to use it to pull a book off the top shelf and to stop her washer from, you know, taking over the house. But it's not okay to try and divine or discern why a vampire might be interested in her.
That's interesting because although she says it's for or not for the purpose of finding out why someone was interested in her, that, I mean, who knows? She doesn't know him from Adam. that could have been her inquiry using magic. That could have been, she could have justified that as potentially saving her life.
Exactly. So to my mind, I don't wonder if Diana only uses magic when it's completely inconsequential. Like the washer, she could have fixed that herself or hired somebody to do it. The book, you go get a step stool. I think the only time that, you know, at least in the first couple of chapters, we see her using magic is when it's completely and totally frivolous.
Which is ridiculous, because you would think that you would save it for the moments when there was no other option.
Exactly. Or if it's because we discovered in chapter one, not discovered, is that, you know, anytime that she's wanted really to do something with it, it hasn't worked.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe that makes sense, though, if she would do it for instances where it didn't mean anything and it wasn't important, as opposed to the moments when, like, it was life or death. That makes sense.
Yeah, so that way if she fails, hey, it's no big, right? Which we know that Diana's become fairly accustomed to failing at big magic.
She hasn't ever been able to do big magic. Exactly. I guess that's what you mean.
Big magic, little magic, candles?
Little magic.
Come on. Magic. Candles can't be big magic.
Books, like that's legit, right? Like those are all little things. If you think of it, like I think if you think of it on a floating power scale, you know, up here is discerning precisely what the vampire's motivations are. And down here is, oh my gosh, should I bend down to tie my shoelaces or just snap my fingers? She's definitely closer to the, I'm going to snap my fingers ability to use power, at least thus far, versus the whole, I'm going to figure out, you know, what's going on inside this vampire's head.
So she's more of a bewitched witch as opposed to like a more magical witch.
I think that's how she frames herself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's what she's comfortable with. I mean, she can chastise herself loosely, like on her list of sins. You know, she brings that up again a couple of different times. The guilt of having used the magic to pull down the volume, you know, bottom of page 16, it had taken all of 3 seconds. I let out another breath to exhale some of my guilt. So she could feel guilty about being successful about these small magics, but won't even allow herself to entertain the big magic.
Well, I think it's easier to live with the smaller magics, the guilt that's associated with that, as opposed to the guilt that's associated with the larger ones, because you think the smaller magics would incur less of an answer back. Like if there's going to be like that threefold, like they always say that, like whatever you put out in the universe comes back threefold.
So yeah, that's a thing.
Right. So if you're putting out something small, the threefold back at you is minor, as opposed to if you're putting out something giant into that threefold, that it's going to be something giant threefold back at you. So maybe she's also working in something about that.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely onto something about that. I also really love chapter two, because we get to see precisely what Diana thinks of the other creatures that are in the world. Because it's in this chapter, we get our first mention of demons and our first mention of vampires.
Agreed. Yes. But can I say something about demons? I still don't 100% know what it is that demons do that is so special. Even after having read all of the books, other than the fact that they're kind of like muses and like they're
crazy
creative,
smart.
Crazy yeah. smart. But other than that, I don't see that there's any real magical quality about them.
I think, you know, I've thought a lot about demons. Actually, the running joke when we were volunteering at the con was everybody was kind of pigeonholed into what type of creature are you sort of game. And I was like, they're like, oh, you're definitely a demon. And I'm like thinking, what about me makes them think this, you know, in the context of the novels? And then I realized, I mean, I'm not like this, but we definitely see this in Haymitch and in a couple of the other demons that we'll meet as the book goes on. Not to get too spoilerized, but I think that you're talking about your savants.
Right.
Yeah.
You're talking about these people who have like innate intuitive knowledge of a thing. And maybe that thing is small. Maybe that thing is grand. And I think kind of like the witches, you have a varying level of power and capability. But what I always found the most interesting was she, you know, Deb kind of has everything counterbalanced, right? As far as power structure goes, you know, witches have weaknesses. Vampires have weaknesses. Daemons have weaknesses. The thing about daemons is that theirs is madness. I mean, this is the end. Like, you know where every single demon life is going to end up, and it's going to be either like the nut house or something more extreme, correct?
Right.
So I think that what demons are meant to be are those people that you can't explain. They have like some genuine and natural intuition for things. And it's something that's completely inexplicable. And I think it's really interesting, you know, as we go through and read the books, the historical characters that Deb calls out as being demons.
And there's a lot more of that to come, because it becomes that whole thing that becomes fascinating, that to look at her through her story, to consider historical figures who fit these descriptions and who you can kind of imagine were this or were that. So before she gets the volume down, she, as you guys said, she does a lot of rationalizing before she proceeds to do magic. Kelly G. wrote, "In rereading A Discovery of Witches, I am struck by Diana's decision to use magic to fetch a copy of Notes and Queries. She is in the Bodleian and believes she is alone and decides not to find a stool and retrieve the copy she needs the human way. Instead, after recounting the number of times she has used magic so far, as Jen pointed out, 5 times, she decides to use her magic to call the book to her. I believe at this time, her use of magic is kind of an invitation." And, you know, that's a very interesting point of view. So immediately she feels 2 icy patches between her shoulder blades. And she knows, and the reader has no clue what's going on, but the next words give us a clue. She'd been seen. We learn through her that when witches look at each other, it tingles. There are other creatures, demons or daemons, creative artistic types, who Deb describes as walking the tightrope between madness and genius. And when they look, she says, it feels like a slight unnerving pressure of a kiss. And I think it's ironic that a group of vampires is called a kiss. And that's our third creature. And then we find out when a vampire looks at her, or looks at a witch, it's cold, focused, and dangerous. Ellen G. writes, "Then the feel of coldness, a vampire, and then a discussion of which magical being used the library. Almost reverse discrimination. We learn that vampires aren't common in reading rooms, though sometimes one succumbed to vanity and nostalgia and came in to reminisce, but it wasn't common. She'd seen other witches, of course, and we had 2, and demons in the music reference room. Vampires, we find, were common in the sciences. Quote, science rewards long study and patience. And, quote, if it went bang, involved blood, or promised to unlock the secrets of the universe, there was sure to be a vampire around. So here we have our first introduction of our third protagonist of this book.
He was in the shadows on the opposite side of the room, in front of the paleography reference books, lounging against one of the graceful wooden pillars that held up the gallery, an open copy of Janet Roberts' Guide to Scripts Used in English Handwriting up to 1500 was balanced in his hands.
And then we get a description of him.
Anyone who's read paperback bestsellers or even watched television knows that vampires are breathtaking, but nothing prepares you to actually see one. Their bone structures are so well honed that they seem chiseled by an expert sculptor. Then they move or speak, and your mind can't begin to absorb what you're seeing. Every movement is graceful. Every word is musical. And their eyes are arresting, which is precisely how they catch their prey. One long look, a few quiet words, a touch. Once you're caught in a vampire's snare, you don't stand a chance.
I think, like, it would be interesting to take a look at for just a second why Deb as an author chose to describe the interactions between species so specifically. So witches, the touch of their eyes tingle. So that says, I see you, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So it's sort of like an intellectual acknowledgement. Oh, I see you. I'm conscious of this fact. However, on page 17, when a daemon takes a look, I feel the slight unnerving pressure of a kiss. That's so invasive, right? I mean, that'll screw you up.
Yeah.
And I think that's the perfect metaphor for knowing a daemon. Just like, you know, if you know a daemon, if you have a daemon in your life, it could totally screw you up. It's going to be invasive and weird and strange, which is all these crazy things that daemons are. And of course, witches are extremely, it sounds like, methodical, intellectual, plodding, definitely much more of a rational sort of experience. And then when a vampire stares at you, it's that of a predator.
Right.
And that's these things kind of immediately sort of, I think, cue to the audience, cue to the reader, exactly how we're supposed to take these creatures, despite anybody else's in the book's perspective on them.
Agreed. And it's followed up with descriptions later from the different characters. Like every time she says, well, there's a vampire. And then Sarah's like, that's a terrible idea. You should not ever interact with that dude. It's bad news. And Emily the same way. Every time she mentions there's a vampire over at Oxford, they're like, this is a terrible idea. Don't even interact with that. So, I mean, that's goes with the whole cold predator moment that you have with that. So I'm totally on board with that.
Yeah, I think Deb definitely goes out of her way to set the tone there.
Yeah, that's true. And also thinking of the word kiss, no. But the way you described it, whereas the way it feels like a kiss when a demon is looking at her, and how, and then you said that you used the word invasive. I thought that was so interesting because, yeah, that relationship, as you said, in this world, if you have a demon in your life, what are they balancing on between genius and madness? And she had already given us a description of, while she's a witch and not a demon, she had given us a description of what happened. Her most demon-like moment, or one of them that we know of, is when she took basically the whole cast of Hamlet almost down with her. And
right,
that, and that was not because of a demon per se, but that is because she so embodied the role, and the magic then basically was given life or went into the production and like made everything embody everything. And she's like, okay, I'm out of here. This is not cool.
No, but she also stated that she was sucking in all the demons. Like she was attracting them.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I think she was also feeding off of their energy at that point. Like they sort of like fed into this madness and sort of helped her get carried along. And so I just think it's kind of hilarious that kind of strange and kind of just, you know, interesting that the only time that you have something that's even remotely either affectionate and or erotic, the mention of a kiss, and that's in reference to demons. So I thought that was really kind of like, oh, wow, I think I know how I'm supposed to view these types of creatures, at least at this point in the novel.
So looking back, I just had a flash of something. Like, I don't want to say books or movies, although certainly they exist. Characters or people from history, people like maybe Mozart or people like Mozart, I would say definitely. I have a harder time saying with someone like Casanova because I don't think he was known for his brilliance. But the reason I think of those two, obviously Mozart for his brilliance and for his genius. But the thing about the image I got just now when you were speaking of demons is someone who can attract others and whose brilliance or whatever, their knowledge or their talent, right? It doesn't have to be like book smarts. It can be their genius in music, their genius in whatever it is, can just drive them crazy, or they can go crazy if they're not, you know, if they don't control themselves or find an outlet for this mental energy, whatever it may be. And I just got a flash of like some, whether it's Mozart or someone else. And I've read a little bit about Mozart. I'm not sure he was necessarily a ladies' man. He may have been, but I just get this image of the talented artist, right? Who attracts all these people because of their brilliance, regardless of how they look. And then just, you know what I mean? And kind of ends up like that sad rock and roller who's incredibly talented, who dies of an overdose in the gutter. You know what I mean?
So I think the one word that comes to mind in listening to you sort of describe this is passion. It's totally passion. And of course, if we're talking about kisses and passion, and so it seems like all the things that you mentioned about demons, I mean, those are all passionate things, right? To be so passionate about music that you dedicate your whole life to it. And of course, we know from personal experience or even just from reading, you know, a variety of books and stories or whatever, that this passion can go horrifically wrong. And I think that that's the key to demons. Demons are kind of the embodiment of passion. And I think that, you know, the flame burns a little too hot and they eventually mentally get burned out, quite literally burned, physically, mentally burned out. And so you're talking about that aging rock star that just can't do it anymore. It's probably not because the heart isn't there, but it's because the flesh can no longer be willing. And so that would be kind of, I mean, what you were talking about, I think is absolutely brilliant, because I think it kind of pins down that passion aspect. Somebody who's so deeply involved. I mean, I'm sure we've all met people who on the surface aren't terribly attractive, right? If you just did like a cold look at them from across the room, wouldn't think much of them. But the minute that they start talking about something that they believe in or that they're interested in or that they're invested in, all of a sudden they just light up like Christmas.
Absolutely.
And whether or not it's a sexual level of attraction, there's still some kind of level of attraction going on. And I think they generate that vis-a-vis their passion as demons. And so, I mean, we'll meet a variety of demons as the books progress, even as this book progresses, who have a variety of passions for things you wouldn't think about somebody being passionate about.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like in the next like 5 or 10 chapters. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's after this discussion we're having right now, that puts that in a whole new light. I think passion is the best way to put it. And just not, it doesn't really matter what it's for. It's just a strong passion for something.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think Diana, you know, I think that Deb through Diana cues us into this by using the word kiss. I think that that's kind of a fulcrum that sort of tips us into that realization. I think it's a major clue. But I think what's more important, though, is that the first impression we get of Matthew before we even know who he is, he's a vampire. He's a predator. And it's that cold, I mean, three adjectives, right? Cold, focused, and dangerous. Those are the three words we have to describe this vampire. All vampires.
And it's kind of not that a vampire, we don't know yet. We haven't discussed it yet. But in her world, we can't say for sure what a vampire is or isn't. But we can say from what at least Diana has just shared with us that they, so far in her summarization of these two creatures, the demons are passionate and potentially invasive, and vampires are dangerous and calculating.
What a great contrast.
Isn't that? I mean, she gives us that.
They're predatory.
Not that,
I mean, that's
not that you can't have a predatory demon,
yeah.
And not that you can't have a passionate vampire, but all we know right now is what she said. Clearly. And it's black and white. It's crystal clear at this moment what we're supposed to view them as she does.
And I think it's really interesting that, you know, as we kind of, you know, as you guys brought up with the whole play and her mixing with demons there, she's far more comfortable and familiar with demons than she is vampires.
Oh, yeah.
Vampires seem like synonymous to alien. It feels like, well, you know, they don't hang out in the same places that I do. I mean, I know they exist, but... I mean, she just doesn't have a whole lot of first-person experience. I mean, she observed one vampire who, you know, is described as cherubic, which, of course, the cherub is a sort of angel, and he's a monk on top of it. I mean, he's essentially defanged for us in the narrative, right? This is kind of like the vampire's not a vampire, man. And I think that, you know, Deb goes out of her way to describe why Diana, who seems very well-versed in her world and all the creatures within it, why she seems so unfamiliar with vampires. And I think it's through her eyes that we, the reader, start to discover who vampires are. You know, she's sort of an outsider at this point. And I think that that's really interesting because she's sort of our guide to the world. So yeah, I think that it's really interesting that she draws this very hard line between this is what witches and demons do, this is what vampires do. And that's sort of on the other side of the Rubicon. It's like, okay, well, you know, we don't know a whole lot about these people. You know, there'd be dragons over here, the dragons and the vampires. And I think that it's very interesting that, you know, in the second chapter, while we meet a vampire, we don't really learn a whole lot about vampires. Like, oh, there's one in the flesh. Hey, check that out. By the way, we still don't know any more. Let's say page 26 than we knew on page 17.
No, but this chapter, we only are introduced to vampires from her point of view. And we learn a little bit more in chapter 3, but we don't learn anything about vampires other than what she has been told herself.
Exactly. Even though we meet one.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's from her description or her view, right? Her description. Mm-hmm. Kelly G. writes, it is so hard now to go back when all I knew of Matthew was what I had read in chapter 2. I see him now so much more fully, but this introduction from Diana's point of view is surely breathtaking. And as Jen said, her personal experience with vampires is mostly limited to her knowledge of a scientist acquaintance, Jeremy, who worked in Switzerland and slept with a lot of ladies. and this one, the one we learned to be Matthew, is well over 6 feet tall. Their eyes were on each other. She calls him physically beautiful, but his combination of strength, agility, and keen intelligence was palpable from across the room.
And I thought what was hilarious is that, you know, at the bottom of page 18, she mentions that one of the most unnerving things about him was not his physical perfection. It was his feral combination of strength, agility, and keen intelligence. I think that that's hilarious. That, like, your first go-to word is unnerving. So the dude's so hot and so smart and so kind of amazing, he just kind of freaks you out. I like that. I think that that's useful.
That is very interesting.
That's awesome that she gets that from this encounter, because they barely talked, but she's getting super intelligent, super all of those things from literally what must have been like a 30-second meeting.
That's a big packed 30 seconds.
Exactly. That's my point. I mean, if I've met a lot of people where there was no conversation, where I didn't walk away going, he was so smart. So
yeah. Like, I meet your eyes and all of a sudden I can see your brilliance just shut. You're blinding me, shining out. Like, what? I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Well, Diana finally gets a move on when she contemplates the word teeth after looking at his smile. She rushes down the stairs and, of course, trips and falls into his arms. He beat her down the stairs. And she says, we learn, that he smells of clove, cinnamon, and something akin to incense. Ellen G. shares, and enter Matthew. Her description of him is so complete. He smiled at her and she went crazy running down the steps, into his arms. She'd dropped her book, and she's shaking. He picks up her book and returns it to her, and he hands her a business card and says, Matthew Claremont. And we find out he's a professor, among other things, he's a professor of biochemistry. But he's got a lot of titles and a lot of degrees. His eyes are gray-green, and he tells her he's an admirer of her work. And she's trying to work this out in her mind. What the heck does he mean? Kelly G. shares, Matthew Claremont is observing her, and his suspicions of her as a powerful witch are confirmed when he sees her display of magic. I can't help but think that his interest in her was strengthened and confirmed when she chose to use her magic. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I'm torn because I've read the third chapter, and knowing from the third chapter, he has some preconceived notions of her based on what he's heard from other people say about her. So he's ultimately confused by what he sees, trying to match what he sees from her activities in the Bodleian as opposed to what he heard from her.
Okay, sticking to chapter two.
Well, sticking to chapter two, I have nothing to say.
Okay, so earlier, you know, when we had our last meeting, we talked about people trying to establish dominance against Diana in conversations, right? They automatically want to have the power dynamic in their favor. I think that Matthew is so extraordinarily guilty of this. I mean, he knows, you know, the minute that he approaches her, he sees her and how he handles the conversation. I mean, this guy is suave. He has got his act together. And I think that he's aware of how attractive he is. He's aware of how intelligent he is. I mean, he's aware of all these factors, right? How just utterly enchanting is a jaw-droppingly amazing vampire, right? A hunk-a-hunk-a burning vampire.
I should hope so after 1,500 years.
Probably isn't that good.
But after 1,500 years, come on. He should know all of those things.
So he's very intimate with his effect on women. And, of course, he leverages that against Diana. He immediately takes charge of her, catches her. She comes down the stairs, doesn't wait for her to catch herself. Although I feel like, you know, maybe she could have, maybe she couldn't. I don't know. Maybe he saved her from like face planning and he's like a total gent and I'm just like really jaded. But I think what's interesting is that he automatically takes control of the situation, physically takes control of her, and then verbally leads the conversation. She doesn't have to say a word. He's just going to talk at her until he gets what he wants. Which at the end, of course, we discover is to secure a date with her. And she rejects him, or she puts him off anyway. And I feel like that's really kind of interesting because once again, here's somebody trying to pin Diana down with a power dynamic, but she kind of scoots off like, nope, not having it.
Yeah. And she's like, no, I've got plans. And, but then he goes on, he at least gets some information. I mean, he obviously already knew this, or he was either making conversation or was trying to let her know that he knew she was going to be around for a while, because he goes on to confirm that she's in Oxford for a year. And so this is something he's letting her know that, you know, there are other opportunities. I'm not going to necessarily let this go.
And I think he says, and I thought so, said Claremont. I'm sure our paths will cross again. Oxford is such a small town. Mm. I wonder how much smaller it feels when there's a vampire hunting you. Oh my gosh. Just out of curiosity.
Oh my gosh.
And when you both hang out at the Bodley Inn repeatedly.
Right. Yeah. Which he's never really entered before, or else he would have had noticed his predatory butt glaring at you from across, you know, staring at you from across the aisle.
But there had to be a reason that he was there. I mean, I think that that night, the fact that he was there that night, he must have been there the night that she called that book forward. Because there was no other reason for him to have any kind of foreknowledge of that.
He heard of it and decided to investigate himself. I think that this isn't coincidental. This was planned, and he perpetuated his little plot to, you know, figure out this little witch who's managed to call down this. I mean, I think that's kind of how he sees her.
Oh, heck yeah. It's true.
Who's managed to call down this manuscript, who he busts for using magic in a library, of all places. And on top of that, apparently can't get it together to utter even a word.
But he's also studied her. You can tell that because of his knowledge of her. Oh, so, yeah. I mean, I don't know how vampires work. They may read super fast. They may be able to do research
there,
like it, that.
There was
in
a
like,
weekend. There was a weekend.
There was a weekend.
Okay. So in that
so
weekend,
he had 2 days to get, if he wasn't already there, he had 2 days to get there.
I like
and read.
To think
she's
he was
chasing
way
down
more
missing
socks.
He's researching
yeah.
her.
Exactly. So somehow she connects Claremont's clove scent with the strange smell of Ashmole 782. I thought that was a very interesting connection because...
You don't say!
I do say. But she does confirm that she will be there. He offers his hand, she hesitates, and then she takes it. And we get more of a hint at how self-denying and rigid Diana is. She says, or we hear the writing from Deb, quote, notes and queries asked me accusingly why I had bothered to go and get it if I wasn't even going to look at it. My to-do list was equally full of reproach. She ripped it up and tossed it aside. She just can't let anything go. She can't just say, okay, this is number 5. Okay, I'll keep it to 5. Let's just let it, you know, I'm keeping the tally. Let's just do it, commit to it, get it done. She, after it's done, she still can't forgive herself.
No, but that's something to remember as you continue reading this book. This is something that follows her. I mean, this is something that is an ongoing issue with her.
And I think she realized it is because the line that we get after that is, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof.
There you go.
Meaning like, I have got so much on my plate, I can't even handle it. Like, this is definitely sufficient amount of trouble. Like, I don't need this to spread any further. I got to get it under control. And I think that she feels like things are very much, at this point in time of the story, very much out of her control.
But I also feel like she almost feels like Matthew is her punishment.
Really?
Like that, in that moment, she's like, ugh, this is what I deserve. They brought this on myself.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. I guess I never thought of it that way. She's basically flagellating herself with a vampire. That's, yeah.
Well, she turns her books in and leaves the library. And as she leaves, she's trying to purge herself of the memory of their meeting. Quote, I sucked the chilly air into my lungs, struggling to get the vestiges of clove and cinnamon out of my nostrils. Kelly G. writes, I find it quite amusing that Diana escapes the library and feels safer in her apartment. She seems laughably naive here, as a door seems unlikely to keep out a vampire.
Well, to be honest, the door did keep him out. He came in through a window.
But it wouldn't have kept him out. But we don't know this yet.
Well, that's what happens when life closes the door, fellas.
That's right.
You go in through the window.
Yeah, exactly.
I think what's interesting about this portion and kind of some pieces that come before that, remember how we talked last time about the ideas of like light and golden and halo and all these things, right? To me, what really struck me about this chapter as I went through and kind of pulled it apart were the images of hollowness. We have, you know, Matthew's pupils, which are, of course, hollow, right? We have the clattering echo of feet in an empty hallway. We have her purging herself, emptying herself. So I think it's really interesting that as much light and darkness that we get in the previous chapter, what I think this chapter sort of centers itself around is this feeling of hollowness.
You know, that's interesting because we
get... The library is especially empty this time. It is...
I think you're onto something because that is a good description, I think, of things, of the library itself and the whole thing, everything that happens inside the library. But then it follows her, I think, and we're getting there, it follows her to her apartment, that even as, not that her relationships with her family are empty, but she is far away from them, and happily so, not happy to be gone from them, but happy in what she's doing. And as you said about kind of how she kind of runs from conflict, right? When she has any kind of her and Sarah don't, you know, Sarah, maybe not nitpicks, but Sarah will say something and go after something. And then she's just like, okay, yeah, okay. You know what I mean? So it's not just the library and Matthew's eyes and her trying to get rid of that, his smell or his taste. She is also, what happens at her apartment is kind of a reminder or a reflection that though she's probably a perfectly fine human being, she's kind of an empty shell.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we were talking earlier about like her level of self-denial that hollows you out after a while. And of course, when she goes to her apartment, what does she pass? She passes windows, empty windows, narrow passages. Once again, like onto page 22, that imagery sort of follows us, follows her as she kind of goes into the narrative, you know, furthers into the narrative. What I think is extremely interesting, what I will always love, are Diana's conversations with Sarah. Because Sarah is like a pit bull, man. And I absolutely love her for it. So instead of like saying, well, hello, darling niece, when she picks up the phone, the first line is, we've been waiting for you to call. Immediately accusatory. Immediately sort of like a cannon, you know, verbal cannon being shot out. And of course, so this is like what, the third person we've had that's tried to conversationally dominate Diana in less than 40 pages. So I feel like that's something that our poor long-suffering Diana has no choice but to deal with, is the fact that there are people who are going to conversationally put her on the spot, demand things of her that she's unwilling to give. Because of course, the next sentence is brief, one word, witches. And then besides Sarah, I'm fine. And so immediately she's kind of blowing Sarah off like, Sarah, I'm fine. Like, will you just stop already? Everything is okay. And of course, we, the reader, know better.
Well, because we were there.
After she gets back to her her rooms, her apartment, we get the first hint that Diana may have a thing for toast. She put the bread in the toaster. I thought, ooh, we have to mention that. Yeah, carbs. More carbs.
Carbs.
And she gets a glass of cold water. She listens to Mozart. And she falls asleep on the sofa. She wakes up at 3:30 in the morning with a pounding heart, stiff neck, and a strong taste of cloves in her mouth. And that's when she decides to call home. And, So we'll probably come back to this a little bit later, but she does. And before she calls home, she turns out all the lights but one and gets out of her dirty clothes. And she asks herself, how do you get so filthy in a library? You know what? That is the first time I recognized that. How did she get so filthy? Was it on the walk home? Because we certainly weren't shown anything from Deborah about her walking through like some woods or anything.
Well, my opinion on that subject is every last book in that library is old. Old books are notoriously dirty because they're old. They've been around for a very long time. Also, she feels dirty because of this is part of her sin that she used magic. She feels dirty about it. It's her sin. And also, I think that her interaction with the vampire also left her feeling a little bit dirty about it.
So here's the interesting part about that, and that is, if you look at the paragraph above, carrying my snack back into the sitting room, I kicked off my shoes and turned on the small stereo. The pure tones of Mozart, as you mentioned, filled the air. When I sat in one of the maroon upholstered sofa, it was with the intention to rest for a few moments, then take a bath and go over my notes from the day. The only reason you would take a bath is if you're dirty.
Yeah.
So she kind of like falls asleep dirty, wakes up dirty. Possibly dirtier.
Welcome to my life.
Hey. You're in a judgment-free zone.
Always.
Judgment-free zone, always. And so to my mind, and of course she leaves that window open. How curious, as we mentioned earlier. When you close the door of the vampire, he'll come in through the window.
You know what, though? I was driving to work today, and this is kind of a non sequitur, but I was driving to work today, and I'm in a ranch-style house, so it's all on the first floor. So I would never leave my window open right now. But I was driving by this apartment complex in downtown, and as I drove by it, I saw, second, third, and fourth story windows, open, wide open. And I thought to myself, if I had a window that was two or three stories off the ground, I would totally leave it open all the time. But because I'm on a one story, I would never leave it open because somebody could totally climb in. But I don't worry about vampires. So if I was in maybe a multi-level apartment building, I might not leave my window open at night. But I would have totally felt secure leaving it open.
I feel like your first mistake is not worrying about vampires.
Clearly.
Diana proves is a bit of a cautionary tale here, right? So I live in a apartment. It's a 2-bedroom, and we're on the first floor. I mean, granted, it's gated, so you have to know the little code in order to get in, or thou shalt not pass. And we have our windows open all of the time, unless my asthma and allergies are acting up, or it's particularly hot or humid, which makes kind of breathing difficult for me. We have the windows open 24/7. We just don't close them. And so I think what's really interesting is that, of course, my windows have a screen. Diana's doesn't. I mean, obviously, right? We don't, she doesn't acknowledge that there's a screen. There's no mention of a screen. So it's quite literally, as you mentioned, a completely open window.
Well, and we see that in chapter 3 when he just vaults in feet first.
Right. Yeah.
I
thought that was extremely, extremely interesting. And of course, what does she wake up after her unplanned nap tasting? Cloves. What does Michael smell like? Cloves. Or Matthew smell like? Cloves. I mean, it's kind of right there, right? Because we have what I thought was very interesting about the structure, not to go too far ahead, because we're going to discuss chapter 3 tonight anyway, is the nesting. The nesting of chapter 3 inside Diana's chapter 2.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we'll get to it, but the switch in perspective. And so isn't that kind of neat? I thought that was really cool because I at first, I actually wound up, when I first was reading the book, I flipped back. I'm like, did I misread something?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. What just happened here? Oh, that's what happened. I wasn't paying attention to the details. She wakes up tasting cloves. Oh, okay. And she's got the window open. That makes a certain amount of sense. All right.
Now,
put together the order of events here.
My only experience with sleeping with an open window is not the UK. It was in Europe. I was in Germany. And I left my window open for a period of time with the light on. That was the real problem, was the light was on. And I didn't realize it was going to be an issue. There were no screens on the window. And at one point, I looked up to the ceiling. I was still wide awake. And I noticed that my white ceiling was now covered in bugs. And I was like, I totally messed this up for myself. So I turned the lights off and I went to bed. And I was going to close the window at that point. But now these bugs are in my window, in my room. So I started in my bed sleeping. But I swear to you, all these bugs were now, once the light went off, dive bombing my head at night. That night, I ended up sleeping under the bed.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Under the bed. So that, again, I would never, ever, ever leave a window that didn't have a screen open at night, ever. Not even vampire-related, just, bug-related.
Bug-related. So as you were saying, Jen, that at that point, she calls home. And Sarah answers immediately and greets her with a, "We've been waiting for your call." And they chat, and she says she's fine, and Sarah says, to the contrary, the cat, Tabitha, has been skittish, and M got a picture of Diana in her mind lost in the woods at night. Now, this is what made me take a double take at Diana's line. Now, Diana was in the library, right? She had just done her laundry, so she had, we think, clean clothes. She was at the library all day where, yes, there may be old books, but those old books are... I mean, not like the manuscripts ones that she were calling. I don't think Diana was crawling around. When you're an acclaimed scholar and you go and you request books or you go get them, you're not dead in the trenches. People are going to get stuff for you unless you pull the magic and get one thing off the high shelf. What I'm saying is she's not crawling around in these dusty old archives. Other people get stuff for her, right? Because she can't go get it if it's something that's in the stacks behind that, in the special collections or something. So then when I read this about M had gotten a picture of her lost in the woods at night, I thought, well, you would get dirty in the woods. I don't know, because Diana's nap happens after she's already dirty, right? You already pointed that out. And then she wakes up and realizes, oh, I don't know how I got so dirty. And then she went and she was going to take her bath, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know how it could have happened, except for in M's vision. And it could have been, it obviously was just that, because we don't have any other evidence that she was actually lost in the woods. But I thought it was funny that after Diana has said twice now, I don't know how I get so darn dirty, I need to take a bath, how her clothes got so dirty. And then we learn from M that she had a vision of her getting lost in the woods at night. I mean, you would be dirty and you would be afraid for someone who was lost in the woods at night. So that kind of stopped me. That could have absolutely no bearing on anything, but I thought it was very ironic or coincidental that she had that vision and Diana somehow ends up dirty.
I think it's interesting, but I also lean towards thinking that that's just a metaphor.
Yes.
Diana's lost, Diana's confused, Diana's at a crossroads where she's going to meet three beasts, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, well, I agree with you that there's some interesting dirt going on, quite literally.
Yeah.
I'm also more prone to think, though, that M was having a bit of a metaphorical dream, because we do find out from, you know, towards the end of the chapter that, you know, M's powers aren't as strong as Diana's mother's. She seems to kind of see things like not quite as accurately. And so it would make sense to me that that would be a metaphor. But I do agree that the dirt aspect, and maybe that's just metaphorical physical dirt from Matthew coming in. I mean, dude breaks into your house. That's true. Dirty.
Yeah. M also, or they, M and Sarah, are both concerned that she hadn't celebrated Mabon.
Mabon? Which one is it? How do you pronounce that?
Mabon.
There it is.
That's how I pronounce it. I have no idea if that's right.
Well, Jennifer Iketa says Mabon.
Mabon?
But I don't know. I'm not an educated scholar on this.
I'm using the British word with a Midwestern accent.
Oh, that's funny.
So that's going to be my excuse for saying it incorrectly, repeatedly. So I probably won't change.
So M, or Emily Mather, had met her mother, Rebecca Bishop, as high schoolers. They became best friends and then pen pals, and M reconnected with Rebecca when she came to Cambridge as a children's librarian. After Diana's parents died, M had come around more and more, and then she moved to Madison and took a job, and then she had become partners with Sarah, or Sarah's partner. And I love Deb's gentle, beautiful description of this relationship, how it developed, how, though they tried to keep it private-ish, everyone knew what was up and respected them just like anyone else.
But it was also listed, like, brought up like it was not a big deal, which I love, because it's not, like, she wasn't like, oh, an FYI, it was kind of scandalous because these two chickies were living together and having whatever. It was just kind of like this matter of fact, like, it's not a big deal, FYI, these two are together. Don't worry about it, it's not a big deal.
I think you're both totally right there. And I think what's hilarious is that M and Sarah seem to think it's a bigger deal
exactly.
than everybody else thinks it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, if, you know, Sarah's trying to keep the facade while Diana was living at home because she felt like, hey, look, I'm her sole guardian. I have to be respectable. I have to, you know, I'm unpaired with someone, I'm unmarried, and so I want to make sure that she knows I'm not behaving in a way that would be most unbecoming for a single parent. But I think what's interesting is definitely that M and Sarah have a bigger problem with how their relationship
I know.
To anyone, including Diana, versus, you know, everybody else kind of from the outside looking in.
Exactly. And they go so far as to never be seen entering a bedroom together, ever. And then when Diana moves out to go to college, M finally moves in. At that point, I mean, they're like, people already know, but at that point, they're finally kind of saying, okay, look, now, you know, let the world find out we're free. So she also came, M, from a long line of witches. It turns out that M had dated, as you guys said earlier, Jillian's mother, and was thus curious about her hanging out with Diana at Oxford.
But what's silly about that is the one thing that was keeping Em and Sarah from being fully together was Diana. And Diana's the one person who couldn't have cared less. Like, mm-hmm. she's the one person who's like, I love these people. Why can't they just be happy and be together? And everyone else in town also already knew, but it seemed like the only thing that kept them from being together was Diana living in the same house.
And I think that does speak to, you know, Em and Sarah's desire for propriety. You know, once Diana left to go to college, I think it's sort of the empty nester syndrome. And so like, oh, well, she's not living here anymore. I'm no longer in quote unquote guardian or mom mode. I can now kind of indulge myself in what I want.
And I can identify with that.
Okay.
She tells them that she met a vampire named Matthew Claremont, and we learn more about Diana's past with attracting demons. Quote, you draw creatures like flowers draw bees, Diana, says Sarah. And she describes the way of the world for witches, demons, and vampires. They, quote, aren't supposed to mix. You know that. Humans are more likely to notice us when we do. No demon or vampire is worth the risk. So basically, she may not agree with or feel the vehemence of those words, or of maybe of Sarah's same feeling of that, the same level, the same intensity that Sarah feels or expresses herself with. However, that's what Diana grew up with, right? That's where Diana's outside of her staying away from magic, choosing to, she also stays away. And this is not only because of her aunt. She would have likely grown up with this anyway, but she grows up with the belief, as we learn later, that pretty much all creatures do, that it is taboo to mix. It's dangerous. Things happen. You do not mix, and you don't hang out, because it's really safer for us all when we don't, because we don't want to risk gaining human attention.
And I think that, you know, as far as like quote unquote rules for this society, I like that, and I find it interesting, that's the first one that we get. Like, okay, there seems to only be one rule so far, and that is, you know, you shouldn't become involved. But of course, you know, we're getting this only after Diana tussles with a vampire. So is this a long, often heard lecture anytime that she kind of chills with a demon? Or is this kind of made even more, like, is there more stress put on this because she's met Matthew the vampire? I personally don't know, but I think the fact that we didn't hear about this rule when she was talking about demons to begin with, which was in several earlier chapters, when she's all like, well, you know, those demons I was traipsing around with when I was a theater student, I really shouldn't have been doing that because, you know, it would draw human attention. We're not worried about human attention until she hits that vampire speed bump.
That absolutely is. That is straight from the text, because she, that right there doesn't reflect, okay, no mixing with creatures. That to me, or only, that to me reflects, it can kind of be brushed under the carpet or the rug, or at least I can turn a blind eye to it, but you interact with a vampire and we're going to bring it down. Because that's basically what matters. That's, we're creating this hierarchy of good to bad or bad to worse. And Ellen, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
On the middle of page 25, we find out, you know, why that might be. And Sarah snorted. He wanted something. Vampires and witches don't go on dates. Unless he was planning to dine on you, of course. They love nothing more than the taste of a witch's blood. That speaks volumes, right? If the dude's asking you out, it's so he can have you for dinner, not have you with dinner, you know, not spend time with you with dinner, maybe have you with dinner. Maybe he's going to have like a croissant and then you, I don't know.
But that was some delightful exposition that was just kind of thrown in on the side. So from that moment alone, we know that witches taste delicious.
Right. And they have every reason to fear vampires.
Oh, sure.
The least provocation. As a matter of fact, they're probably on the menu somewhere.
Yep.
Ellen G. comments on the three species not mixing. Why, she asks, racists' attitudes of older generations imposed on all magical beings. And Kelly G writes, Diana doesn't seem to have much actual experience with other creatures, since there is a taboo on too much intercreature mixing. Her understanding seems highly filtered through her Aunt Sarah's prejudices and disdain for demons and vampires. So our first introduction to magical creatures is also rather limited and will expand as we read further and meet them ourselves. Yeah. We get more of a taste of the even-tempered M. Oh, I love M. Quote,
I love that you use the word taste.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, it just happened. Quote, not everybody obeys the rules, honey. Not everybody obeys the rules, honey. What did he want? And she was speaking of the vampire. She says, dinner, but not dinner, says M. And they have conversation of how her refusing to use even the simplest magic likely led to this. And okay, this is just side comment. I did not take notes on this. It's funny how after we've had our conversation up till now that they discuss how her refusing to use music is great. She used tons of Mozart. To use the simplest magic likely led to this. Well, it's actually it's who she is that led to the meeting, because
if he sought her out because of hearing about a witch who called forth the Ashmole 782. Thank you.
This is going to be reused a lot.
I know. But if that's what called him forward, then it had nothing to do with the rest of it.
It had nothing to do with her use of magic.
Or her lack of use of magic.
Lack of use or use is still use.
Here's what I'm going to throw in for my two cents. This may mean nothing, but I think what at least when I read it and when I've reread it, I think what M was trying to communicate, you know, if Diana, if you used your magic, if you were at Mabon in the first place, this could never have happened. If there was a coven of witches that you accepted as sisters and they were a support system for you there, this vampire wouldn't have dared approach you. You don't use magic, and your denial of what you are has now invited this vampire into your life. Congratulations.
Yeah, fair enough. She would have been elsewhere. If nothing else, she would have been elsewhere.
Well, and she would have been surrounded by people who would have been having her back.
Exactly. She would not have been all alone by herself, you know, both in the physical as well as kind of like the metaphorical sense. Diana as we've remarked multiple times, you know, because it appears in the manuscript, takes pains to separate herself from anybody that uses and accepts magic as like, hey, this is what we are. This is what we do. This is how it is. Because she's made those choices, she's made herself vulnerable to multiple interactions with demons and made herself vulnerable to be approached by a vampire in this way. If, let's say, she'd been hanging out with Jillian, do you think he would have come up to her? Probably not. He wouldn't have been able to control that situation. But that she was alone gave him complete control over the situation.
Exactly. And Sarah says then don't call us looking for answers when you don't want to hear them. And then she hangs up. M is calmer, and she is ever the diplomat. Diana says using magic is a slippery slope, and she is afraid that if she uses it for small things, then she'll come to rely on it for bigger things and then won't be able to know what or if her work is her own. Quote, I don't want to be the next Bishop Witch. M's sixth sense picks something up. Claremont knew Diana's name. M said it must be her pictures on the inside of the latest book cover, and that placates both of them for now. M tells her, quote, be careful. English vampires may not be as well behaved around witches as the American ones are.
I'm sure that's it.
Well, yeah, that's all it's all about him being English.
I prefer English vampires.
Well, I mean, they taste better. I'm sorry.
I can't speak to that. I would just, I'm more evenly tempered towards anyone with an accent, to be honest.
I think I just immediately went to English breakfast tea, and that's delicious.
That is delicious.
I thought English vampires, I mean, the whole cloves thing, I don't know. I'd also, in the back of my head, Picard's voice is going Earl Grey hot.
Make it so.
Make it so.
Diana says that she'll probably not see him again, meaning Matthew.
That's a lie.
M is quiet and says only. Yeah, exactly. M is quiet and says only. Time will tell. So I had a question at this point. So
hasn't she said that in both chapters now?
I probably
won't see him again.
I'll never see this guy again.
She didn't see him in the first chapter.
Okay, well then I was remembering it from something else, but she's been saying that, like, that's something that carries forward. She's like, I'm never going to see this guy again. It's never going
to
happen.
What you're remarking upon is that every time something queer happens to her, she says, oh, that's never going to happen again.
Yeah, I'm speaking of M's being quiet and then saying only time will tell. Because we know M has, if not as clear as her mother's, we know that M has the sight. And when she's quiet, my mind jumped through this reading, or during this reading, my mind jumped ahead to, oh, I wonder what M sees.
My mind jumped ahead to book 2 and book 3. So I know exactly what M sees.
But see, Deb has made a point to let us know that M's sight is not perfect and is not as powerful as Rebecca's was. So
my recollection of the last two books is...
I'm not talking about the last two books. What I'm saying is, because we've read the books, we know what happens.
Yes.
But that does not mean that choices weren't made that made other things that could have happened happen or not happen. And what we don't know is, number one, what she saw, and to how much or to what level of detail. So all I'm saying is I'm very curious what or how much M saw.
And I think what's interesting, too, is that Diana is not vulnerable when she's talking to Sarah. Sarah's kind of battling at her, and Diana's battling back. And you know, Sarah's laying down terms, and she's rejecting those terms. She only lets herself be vulnerable with M. Because it's only to M, after Sarah hangs up, that she says the part that you just mentioned. He knew my name. I've never seen him before, but he knew who I was. And so M knows something's going on. Diana tells her exactly what's going on. And, you know, then M considers the possibilities, like a logical possibility could be your picture's on the inside of your latest cover of your book, isn't it? And then that asking that question, cueing it as a question, calls a response from Diana to say, oh, yeah, it is. You're probably right. M's whole goal isn't to scare Diana away. As we kind of already, you know, as you guys already said, you know, she sort of acts as the mediator. She's sort of the politician. She's trying to make sure that, you know, that there's not all out war between, you know, the two bishop witches. And so I partially think, to kind of talk about, you know, your point of curiosity, that her vague premonition, she's not going to share it because she doesn't want to terrify Diana needlessly. Her goal isn't to scare her. Her goal is to just kind of listen to what Diana has to say and attempt to be helpful. Whereas, you know, Sarah's like, okay, it's fire and brimstone time. Everything's gone sideways. You need to start, you know, doing what I tell you to do. Emily's far more cautious.
I also think that M knows that knowing what's coming isn't going to change it. And she doesn't also want to affect anything. And if she sees something awesome happening, telling somebody that something awesome is coming is going to affect it. So I think that being like, okay, we'll see what happens.
I agree.
It's the safest course of action.
But the other side of that, and also goes along with being safe by not saying something, is because just because you see something doesn't mean it's going to happen. It's based on choices as something is laid out at that moment. So just because you see something, I think you see a possibility. So by her saying, you know, oh, I see this. Well, first of all, that may not come to happen. It may come to happen. But yeah, either way, she's potentially changing whatever course. And then you get that whole time question of, well, is something set in stone or is it not? Is, you know, the whole butterfly effect. So that can... I get headaches of joy talking about time and time travel. And it's so much fun, but it's also a headache.
We keep picking books with time travel.
Seriously. Well, we can't say that yet, Summer.
Nope, sorry.
So Kelly G writes, I just love them here. Their conversation with Diana perfectly encapsulates their personalities and relationship with each other, as well as their niece. Harkness does a great job bringing them to life through a phone call, which can't be easy. You immediately get a sense for Sarah's cut-and-dry way of seeing the world and M's softer approach. You can tell they're both afraid for and frustrated with Diana for her rejection of her magical self. Sarah's short temper is illustrated, but you also get a strong sense of her love for Diana. We also have some audio feedback from Laura.
Hello, Ginger and Summer. This is Laura from the All Souls Con Northern California headquarters. I'm really excited that you're starting the read-along for A Discovery of Witches. And anyway, where to start? Chapter 1 and 2 are most definitely two of my favorite chapters in the entire trilogy. I guess it's because we get to meet the three protagonists, Diana, Matthew, and Ashmo 782. But we also get to meet other characters who I really love, Sarah Bishop and, yes, Stephen Proctor. I don't want to leave a 30-minute long voicemail, so I will focus on one theme that struck me the first time I read A Discovery of Witches and continues to actually get my attention every time I reread A Discovery of Witches. And from the very beginning of the series, I get the sense that Diana is very lonely. She lost her parents at a young age, and she has turned her back to her magic and the community of witches, and even the only family she has left, Sarah and Em. In a way, she kind of, you know, keeps them at an arm's length. It seems to me that she was sort of lost for a very long time. We learn that she attempted several majors in college until she finally found her call with, you know, studying history. Basically, I get this very deep sense of loss from the very first chapters. And again, when we meet her in chapter one, she's studying the entire day by herself, spending, you know, long hours at the Bodleian. She turns down invitations from Julian Chamberlain for obvious reasons. She doesn't want to hang out with other witches. But we don't learn about Chris Roberts until later. Again, I really feel, you know, that running from who she is a very lonely business for her. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. And thank you. I can't wait to listen to your podcast.
Okay, so we are going to basically jump into chapter 3 because it is so short. We thought we'd give you guys an extra little treat.
So short. It almost seems a shame to try to dedicate an entire episode to three
pages. Exactly. That's why we're going to just clip it in here. And a little, like, you'll get a twofer this week. It won't happen every week, but this week you get a twofer.
Bonus.
Exactly. A bonus for free. So chapter 3. It's very interesting. We do get uses of, well, on one sided, obviously, we get the use of names, but the chapter starts with the words the vampire. And later on, it continues with the witch. And so it's not about personages or personalities, it's about creatures. And Matthew goes back and forth between calling Diana witch, bishop, and Diana bishop. And
I mean, they're all kind of interchangeable.
No, but they mean different things. One is less personal. One is more, not say professional, but still kind of removed. And then Diana Bishop is still quite formal. It goes from, you know, witch, which almost leaves a nasty taste in my mouth kind of thing. Like, ugh, witch. Because that can be used as a curse, right? Ugh, witch. Like in the musical.
Like an epithet?
Yeah. Like in the musical Wicked, right? Granted, it's more than one word. But it's like, burn the witch. I don't think he used it that way. He didn't call her an epithet. But by using the word witch, it is so impersonal. It is, barely descriptive.
It definitely could be taken that way. But I think that when you live in a universe where you have people that are described as demons, whatever, people that are described as vampires and people that are described as witches because that's what they literally physically are, I don't think that it necessarily has to be an epithet.
I didn't say it was an epithet.
I think what you can boil it down to is levels of knowing. I mean, we go from being very vague to being very specific. And that is, you know, witch. And then, of course, Diana Bishop, like Dr. Diana Bishop, and then to Diana. Those are all indicators of tiers and level of knowing someone. I actually had this conversation with Tim over dinner the other night. And that was, if I just casually know someone, I prefer that they call me Jennifer. If I'm actively friends with someone or they're like a member of my extended family, Jen is preferred. If they're a member of my intimate family, my immediate family, then Jenny is occasionally acceptable. Like I'm done trying to fight it. I just accept it. But those are...
What about JT?
JT, that's genuinely confusing. As somebody who's used to being like the ninth Jennifer in a room of 15 people, it's out of control. So I think that what we're discussing here is something that I think we do in our daily lives. And that is, you know, if I don't know you very well, I'm not going to feel comfortable abbreviating your name. that sort of extends to a certain bit of familiarity that isn't there. Like you haven't established that joking relationship, to sort of use anthropological terms, right? Instead, you're more of an acquaintance relationship. So therefore, you know, if a coworker or an acquaintance, it's Jennifer. And I'm very comfortable with that. And I like it. If it's someone I'm on very close terms, like we've hung out or we've connected, like we have this, you know, over this book, then Jen is fantastic. So I think that we have different levels of naming that we ourselves, whether we're conscious of it or not, find acceptable. And I think that you're both right when you say that witch is both just a general descriptive term, but it's also kind of, it can be used dismissively, as we saw in the conversation that Diana has with her aunts. And that is witch.
That's it. You took the words out of my mouth. Exactly. And she wasn't cursing at them, but it was used as a...
It was dismissive.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, what a witch thing to do. Or witches, gosh, can't do anything with them. I think it can't. I think it has been used as a curse in these books. I think that that's accurate as well. We haven't gotten there yet, but we will. And I think that definitely when... Gosh, I always say her name wrong. We haven't gotten to her yet, but Matthew's mother... When she says the word witch, tell me how that comes across to you. How does that make you feel?
Well, the context with which she says it is completely different, because you know going into it the history she has with witches.
Exactly. So to her, to call someone a witch is probably the single worst description you can give them in varying levels of accuracy. So I think that you're both right. Oh, hey, look, I'm Emily. right, in the sense that it's definitely a word that has a multitude of connotations and meanings in the book. But I do think that I agree completely that opening up the chapter with the vampire, that automatically switches our perspective. This isn't something that Diana is observing. This is a third person omniscient observation. Diana isn't observing the vampire. There's no one there to observe the vampire, which is kind of creepy because we know all about him now. From chapter 3, we know a little bit more about him and a lot more about Diana. But the fact that she opens it up in such like an open sort of way really kind of cues you into a decisive and distinct perspective shift. We are out of Diana's mind and we've entered into the realm of general narration. And I think that shift is important because it eases then into, of course, Matthew's mind and Matthew's observances.
Yes.
Observations.
And we basically learn, or the beginning of the chapter is basically description of his stalking her.
Yes. Creepy, creepy dude stalking you.
Well, not just stalking.
No, it's true. But let's be honest, if he was not as good looking and not as physically fit, it would be way creepier.
Are we making the 50 Shades of Grey argument? And that is, if Christian Grey lived in a trailer park, this would be an episode of Criminal Minds.
Yes. Oh my God. Absolutely.
I think that Deb, either unintentionally or intentionally, really exacerbates and really stresses Matthew the Predator. Dude is on the hunt. And this is really dangerous because he is all about invading her personal space. I mean, he B&E's her house and observes her while she's sleeping. That's not creepy at all.
No, and he stands there. He stands there and then admits that it had been like an hour. He's like, it might have been a few hours. I stood here watching her breathe in and breathe out.
Wah, wah, wah. With power, too, right? So not only is he just like straight chilling by her bedside, yo, babe, what's up? See, you're unconscious. That's cool. But you're emitting this really weird glow that's kind of disturbing. So I'm going to watch you for a while to make sure I'm getting the whole picture here. Creep-tastic. Yeah,
not even bedside, couch-side. Couch side. She's asleep on the couch.
Couch side. Well, you know, the bed's a metaphor. The couch is a metaphor. The cake is a lie. I don't know where I'm going with this.
So what you just pointed out made me think of something else. And I had some description from earlier in the chapter that I thought, oh, interesting. And I'm like, nah, it's not important. I won't necessarily bring it up. But given what you just said, this makes me even more interested in this. Okay, so him, and he's a guy, right? He's a dude. I'm not calling him a name. He would represent the masculine, the phallus, right? He's going into her home. He's invading. He's the predator. That's very masculine, it's mimicking, you know, I mean, hopefully not, but mimicking the sexual act, correct?
Are you calling him a dick?
I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, not at all. What I'm saying is, I'm speaking metaphorically. So who he is and what he is and the predator and him going in, not just the vampire, he goes in for the kill, but also as a male, the female is the receptive. The male is the more...
He's the giving.
The giver. Yeah, exactly. So when you guys were talking about, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like the ultimate, like breaking into someone's home, right? Into this safe or safe place. So he's given a lot when he breaks in. And that's a very kind of...
Are you trying equate this to rape?
I don't want to say he's definitely not raping her. But in a metaphoric sense, it kind of is. He's interrupting her safeness, her cocoon. And although he doesn't hurt her physically, he invades her space. So that's maybe a type of something like that. And the reason I found that interesting, and the reason I'm going to share what I wrote down in the beginning, is because it mimics this thing about masculine feminine. So the chapter opens with, again, the words "the vampire," and he's in the shadow. So that's dark, that, you know, more of the whole light dark play. And he's waiting. Deborah goes out of her way to say that he's waiting against, or standing against, the curved expanse of the bridge. So we've got two things here. It's dark, or three things, I guess. It's a curve, which is feminine, right? It's not straight, it's not harsh and male, it's curved and feminine. And it's next to another bridge. You brought up last chapter how Diana is, there's a lot of that bridge imagery.
I agree with you in that Diana is a bridge, but I really do believe that in chapter 3, Matthew's a total dick. Like, he's a concrete dick. The things he thinks about Diana, he thinks so little of her. I mean, on page 28, he accuses her of outright thievery with the statement of, "Still, there was no chance that a witch, a bishop, would have let the volume slip through her fingers." And then on page 29, he insults her intelligence. "Without magic, how could a modern woman understand what men who lived so long ago?" I'm sorry. It's called research and imagination. Come on.
Oh, he's very, I mean, other than being there for a cause, for a purpose, he is, of her abilities, very dismissive. Very like, dude, no, she has to be using a mat. There's just no way.
Right. She can't possibly be that intelligent. She can't possibly have just left the manuscript. She's obviously, you know, this diabolical, cunning, yet not too bright creature that I see big before me.
But doesn't she question that about herself at some point later in the book?
Well, there's difference between internal self-criticism versus it coming from an outside place. And I think that you're correct when you nail the gender element, because that can't help but come into play. The fact that we, in that sentence, "How could a modern woman understand men who lived so long ago?" I'm sorry, but isn't that kind of what historians do regardless of gender? Like, regardless of their gender and regardless of the gender of the person that they're studying? I think that it's really kind of like a sleazy move. So not only does he break into her place, but then he insults her repeatedly. Like, okay. Come on!
But if Deborah hadn't stated a woman... If she hadn't said, "How could a woman have known what these people were like, or guessed what these people were like, and been so accurate about these people that I personally knew hundreds of years ago," if she hadn't made the point of saying, "How could a woman," would it have been as offensive?
I don't think so, no. I don't think that she would have listed the genders. It would have been nearly, I mean, it still would have been like kind of a slap, but it wouldn't be like a gender-based slam. It just would have been a critique of her intellect.
Exactly, because he's not saying... Dude, there's no such thing as any historian being so talented, you know, human or whatever, as being able, because he's not making a blanket statement. Now, he may feel this way, he may truly think it, but he's not saying there's no way a historian, right, without the use of magic or whatever it is, any historian could hit the nail on the head so well for people who, that, you know, they never met, they never knew, people that I knew. There's no way. So he may truly think that it's true that no one's capable of that. But that's absolutely not what comes across. He's totally honing in on her and saying, there's no way this woman, a woman, can do this without her magic.
Right. But my question is, and this is just, I guess I'm a little more enlightened about Matthew because of where I am in the books right now. But if he hadn't made the whole woman comment, period, if he hadn't made that, it would be safe to say that in the last however many years he's been alive, which we'll come to find out later, which is a very long time, that he's read lots of historians' accounts of people's assumptions made based on their research and the time periods and things that all of the conclusions that they're drawing, and none of them have been close to capturing the essence of the people he knew. And if that's the case, and she, a historian who's younger than he thought she would be based on her work, is getting so much closer to pinning the nail on these people without having the experience, It's him making that jump of the only way that that could possibly be possible with all of my years of experience and my personal knowledge of these people is if she's using some sort of witchcraft.
I think that one of the things that always comes across about Matthew, which I think makes him an enduring and moreover kind of an interesting and true character, is that he is definitely a man of his times.
Yeah.
And I think that his chauvinism towards Diana, it just happens. I mean, from trying to control the conversation with her, to the way that he approached her, to the way he handled that encounter, all the way to the manner in which he broke into her rooms. And on top of that, his internal narrative, based upon his observances, is really telling. I think at no point in time, I mean, I think that Matthew, for being somebody who is so old, is amazingly progressive. But I still think that one of the reasons that Matthew rings true to his time period is that he does think things like that. And even though he himself, you know, and I think that we'll get into it later when we talk about Matthew's relationship with his mother and some of these other things, I think that at no point in time is Matthew so progressive that he feels completely modern. There's a part of him that's always kind of lagging behind him in the past. And I think that his view on women is one of those things.
I have to agree, because once we learn, again, not an excuse, but perhaps a helpful explanation in part of why he is the way that he is that he is not a spring chicken. And we'll learn more detail about his experience and his age as we progress in this book. As you guys already said, he ends up going through her window, and it's funny, he had done this before, we learn, but only when he'd been infatuated. And we get two hints about what he's doing here. Number one, it's not infatuation, and number two, it's very different from that. So, like, almost the opposite. It's more investigative. So then we find out he's looking for Ashmole 782, and he searches through her rooms, and he obviously sees Diana, notices her eyelids are twitching, a hand's in a fist, her legs were dancing. He knew something wasn't right, so she's not just, like, some chick who fell asleep on the couch. Something's going on, and he notices her scents. They weren't the usual witch's scents of henbane, sulfur, and sage. Quote, she's hiding something. Something more than the lost manuscript. That's the first hint, other than Diana's own, I will not do magic, I will not do magic. That's the first hint we get of someone outside of Diana also noticing, you know, that something is maybe wrong with her. Something is maybe not quite right with her. He looks for the book, and as he's looking for it, he smells electricity. And he turns and sees pale blue light emanating from Diana's pores. And we learn why he was so shocked. Quote, it was impossible. It had been centuries since he'd seen such a luminous outpouring from a witch. So that gives us a tiny clue as to how old he is. At least a few centuries, right? And we learn about two other witches, and this is where that gossip comes in. We learn about two other witches who'd been gossiping about Ashmole 782 and the witch who'd called it. One said she'd not used her power. He suspected she had used her magic, though, as he'd seen her do it in the Bodleian. And we also, another time, get a hint of Matthew's age again. He had been friends with Cornelius Drebbel, who lived from 1572 to 1633, Andreas Libavius, who lived from 1555 to 1616, and Isaac Newton from 1642 to 1726. So it kind of gives us a time frame. He's at least of an adult age, because if you're 10 years old, you're probably not going to be chummy with these guys, right? Of any kind of, like, head, be articulate enough or be well-studied or well-read enough to kind of hang with these people and be intellectual buddies with them, right? So he was probably of at least a well-formed adult age at the earliest or middle of those times of those three men's lives. The clock strikes three. We learn he'd been there for several hours, and he's thirsty, and he does momentarily consider drinking from Diana because he says that that might give him the information he's looking for. But he resists. He tells himself, and thus us, that it was his goal to only search for Ashmole 782, and he decides it must still be in the library. And as he leaves, Deb describes his leaving as he melted into the night.
I mean, that's the only way that a vampire should leave a room, I think.
Melting?
Melting. Just melting out of the room.
Although it does invoke a certain amount of Wicked Witch of the West.
Oh, I mean, he entered feet first through a kitchen window, and he melted into the night.
That's funny, that the word melting with the kitchen.
That's right.
So it's like it's a block of good Wisconsin cheddar.
Absolutely. Yeah, clearly is. I would totally
eat
that.
Or chocolate. I don't know.
Maybe both. I mean, we can fondue. Oh.
Yes.
And bring it back around before we wrap up. Fondue can be low carb.
Depends on what. I mean, most things can be, depending on what you dip in it.
Well, that's true. But I'm just saying, no bread. Use the veggies or something. Or meat.
I feel like I'll be greatly disappointed if we ever fondue and it's low carb.
Hey, it's just, we can cheese the dip up and you dip in it what you want. I'm just not going to use bread.
Oh, I'll probably use bread. Because again, once we have like, when there's like, you know, if you're planning a trip for like 2 or 3 months or whatever it is, and you're going to get together with someone, you know, you may not go whole hog, but you're going to enjoy yourself. And that's why the whole 90-10 or 80-20 or whatever it is do it. You know, you do your plan, whatever that is, for 80-90% of the time. And you make allowances, if you feel okay with that, for the special occasions.
And for my vegetarian friend here, I will ladle out some fondue into a bowl and dip my meat in it. She won't eat the fondue if I dip meat in it.
Well, I don't blame her if she's vegetarian.
Yeah, she's weird like that.
This is getting a little personal here, ladies.
Veggies are weird.
we're not weird, we're selective.
Okay.
Or maybe at least I'm selective.
Yeah.
Okay, well, is there anything more closing up chapter 3? Or actually 2 and 3. Any kind of summaries or some more insights before we close?
I will say that Chapter 2, the introduction of Matthew, was the chapter that was read from at the All Souls Conference. Was it the convention or conference? I don't know. It was just a con. It was a convention.
Convention.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so the All Souls Con. And Jennifer Iketa did read from that introduction of the two of them. And so it now will forever have a special place in my heart.
Yeah, chapter. I definitely now, when I was rereading it, read it in her voice. I mean, granted, the rest of the book I don't, because I haven't had much experience with the audiobooks, but listening to her read it, I think it actually gave me a slightly different perspective on Matthew, which I thought was very interesting because of certain words that she chose to stress and so on and so forth in the manuscript. But what I think is great about chapters 2 and 3 is the amount of world building we get that's just sort of kind of snuck in there. You know, we get the major rule about how you're not supposed to fraternize with other types of creatures. We get an idea about what Diana's responsibilities really are and kind of how she's shirking them even more than, you know, chapter 1 may have alluded to. And I think it's interesting that we also get like a more well-rounded view of what a demon is. And of course, yeah, as you mentioned, we get to meet our first vampire who sort of hits all of those, you know, vampire cliches, right? And I kind of wonder, does he hit all those cliches because that's just how Diana sees him? Or because genuinely all of those stereotypes exist for a reason, because they're true. You know, there's some level of truthfulness there.
I think there is, but I also think that he is like the most OCD vampire that we will meet in the series. Like he lives by his rigid rules and regulations and things he has to do to maintain his normal. And we'll find out more about that later, but I mean, I think that feeds into a lot of it. Like, he is, like, the super, hyper, stereotypical vampire.
Control freak.
Yeah.
Lord of the night.
All of it.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, as we read on, vampires, there's parallels drawn between vampires and different kinds of animals, specifically, that also share those very self-same traits. And so as we sort of are rereading these, are re-listening to these chapters, I think it's really kind of interesting to see how the foundation for all of this is so very carefully and artfully laid by Deb.
And with that, I think we will say good night, ladies.
We will wrap up our chapter three.
Good night, ladies. Sorry. Good night, ladies. We're going to see you now.
You keep saying sorry, but then you kept singing. I had to finish the verse. That worked.
I kind of felt like so long, farewell, future Sam.
Thank you. I'll go with that one. I like that one too.
Yeah. I don't know why my brain automatically defaults to Sound of Music.
It should. It's one of the most perfect musicals ever.
I don't even like musicals, so.
But that makes
it's
it
kind
even
of
cooler.
Mildly horrifying, but yet it keeps happening.
But we still love you.
So I love that in my brain now. Whenever you have a musical going on, your brain is going, "Oh my god, it's happening! Make it stop! No."
Why would you do this to yourself? I don't know.
But see, that's exactly what goes through my... Actually, it comes out of my mouth as Ginger starts singing show tunes in the middle of our podcast. I'm like, no, stop. Why? So that was chapter 3. Be sure to come back for our next episode when we will be discussing chapter 4. So a big, huge thank you to Jen Tepp for joining us again to discuss chapters 2 and 3 of A Discovery of Witches. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. You can find our audio channel at www.audioboom.com/channel/AllSoulsPod. Many thanks to Penguin Audio and Recorded Books for allowing us to use portions of the audiobooks in our show. Visit our website at www.allsoulspod.com. Follow us on Twitter at AllSoulsPod. Find us on Facebook by searching for The All Souls Podcast, or email us at allsoulspod@gmail.com.